You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast, where we talk about technology that can serve the church and its work of spreading the gospel. Wells Tech is a part of the podcast network on Streams, the internet media site sponsored by the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Join the conversation by visiting our podcast website at wellstech.wells.net. Today is Wednesday, April 16th, 2008, and welcome to episode 15 of the Wells Tech Podcast. I'm Martin Spriggs.
And I'm Sally Draper.
And we are your hosts for our weekly conversation about technology and ministry. Good morning, Sally.
Hi, Martin. How are things in Milwaukee this morning?
I'm good. Good. I got a little taste of what it's like to be you last week.
Uh-oh, what does that mean? Kind of scary.
That means I spent most of my time in training classes. I conducted 9 training classes last week, from our Outlook training that we're doing here in the building, Outlook and voicemail. We launched a new voicemail system that integrates with your inbox. Of course, we did the Shepherd staff training together during the week and on the weekend. And then we did some video conferencing training for world missionaries on Thursday and Friday, and that was kind of fun to be able to work with them and see some of the excitement that they have about being able to use technology for distance learning purposes. So technology can do some amazing things, but it requires planning, and you're well aware of this, documentation and training, if people are really going to get it, you know, and use it.
Absolutely. I was very excited to participate with those missionaries myself, and the only downside was we actually turned on the web cameras this time, so I had to
well,
take
it was,
the...
It was training on video conferencing.
Yeah. So. Had to take those curlers out of my hair so I'd look presentable. You know, working at home, you don't have that layer normally with mm-hmm. your interactions. So technology is getting a little more savvy with the whole webcam mm-hmm. thing.
Yep, but it worked out well, since now they got a chance almost to, you know, not, it wasn't really the same as you being here, since you're, you know, you're holed up in Sleepy Eye, Minnesota, and we're over in Milwaukee. But it certainly, I think, it adds a little bit of a different dimension to training and to conference calls, when they can actually see the person that they're talking to rather than just this disassociated voice on the speakerphone. So that was, I think that was a great thing, and it worked well.
Yes, it did. I was quite impressed. I could even zoom in on you guys and using the camera there at the SAB, and so that mm-hmm. was cool. I was having fun playing with the technology myself. So
yeah, and that there's going to be more and more of that. So we do need to get used to it and use it. So we used a technology called VC. I don't think we've talked about that on the show before. VSEE.com is a video conferencing product. It's actually free for smaller groups to use. So if you want to try that out, go to VC.com. There's a demo there that you can try. It's just a quick little download that installs on your computer. It only works on Windows, does not work on Mac, at least at this point. But it's a mature enough technology that I think it's going to be real useful for our missionaries, especially for distance learning. Well, the theme of our show this week is thin. It's not a show about weight loss, although I could stand to lose about 10 pounds myself, but a show on thin client computing. A few weeks back, we talked about one side of that with the virtual office, and we also talked about some open source tools that help us create that virtual office. And it's thin in a couple ways. It's thin as far as the requirements on the desktop or laptop side, but it's also kind of thin on price, because a lot of these things that sit out there for our use are there's no fee for.
Yeah, I think that's what's got my interest piqued more than anything else. I told my husband this morning, it's almost like the garage sale side of me came out, you know, and I hear bargain prices, and that makes it that much more appealing to me. And just the idea that our technology money can go further if we can use it in this way to use these free open source tools and spend the dollars on other areas where we need to beef up as well.
And that's kind of one of the hopes that I think we both had in creating this podcast, is to call attention to some of these resources that are out there that are either inexpensive or no cost, and give a little bit of a review, get a little bit of encouragement out there for congregations and schools to think about using these things and what they could be used for. There's a lot of value there, and just good old-fashioned stewardship when thinking about spending money on technology and actually getting good value for what you are spending, or in some cases what you don't have to spend at all. But there always is some effort and a learning curve, and we want to help our listeners through that as well.
Absolutely. I was excited about interviewing Mr. Plucker this morning. We're going to play an interview with Mike Plucker, who's the technology director at St. Paul's Lutheran School in New Ulm, Minnesota, and just kind of explore what they're doing in their computer lab setting. Actually, we're kind of on the verge of making decisions about new computer lab equipment here at St. John's and Sleepy Eye, so this topic was real timely for me. And just to hear about what's going on at St. Paul's and the potential with the hardware and software combination that they've put in place there really kind of makes you think a little bit about the traditional way that we've been doing computing in the past, mainly with Windows-based boxes, and moving away from that scenario into kind of a new world. And it's an interesting jumping off point, and I'm not quite sure if we're ready to make that decision here in Sleepy Eye or not. We're still debating.
Mike raised some great points, and we're going to listen to that interview in just a minute. One of the issues that it raises is it takes some skill, at least at some level, to determine what kind of infrastructure is needed, you know, at a school. Those decisions need to be made, and you kind of have to have a feel for what's going to work and what's not going to work. And maybe the biggest question is, how do you manage it? Who's going to manage it, both in the church and the school, as technology becomes so necessary to get the job done, to do record keeping, to do communications, to do the word processing and publishing that's necessary to do promotion within a church or school? The best way to do that is with technology, but that takes somebody to sit down and think about how best to do that. What software applications are needed? What kind of hardware is necessary? And Mike has been in technology for a long time. He is probably the exception rather than the rule in a lot of our churches and schools. He's at a larger church and school where they have somebody that's dedicated, or at least semi-dedicated in his case, to thinking about technology, but a lot of our churches and schools don't have that person.
Right. A lot of them are relying either on tacking on that technology requirement to one of the full-time teachers, or involving volunteers in the congregation who have that technical knowledge to make these kind of decisions and support the decisions once they're made. And so it may be an area where congregations really need to explore and put some thought into dedicating the right amount of man hours to the project, and beefing up the talents and skills of the personnel involved. If they don't have, for instance, networking skills or whatever, you know, seeking out some training and helping them to get those skills. Certainly you can involve volunteers, and they don't always have to be on site to manage your software and hardware solutions. There's ways that they can telnet into your network and things like that. But it does take some considerable planning and infrastructure decisions in order to do that kind of thing.
In general, most of our churches and schools are probably going to need some kind of hybrid solution, at least in my opinion, where they have a staff, a full-time faculty member or church staff member, making decisions at least about technology, but perhaps in conjunction with a staff of or a group of volunteers. The good news is that many of our congregations now have technically savvy individuals, some even working in the field. And as you mentioned, there is the ability for some of that maintenance by those volunteers to go on without actually having to be in the building. I think you've got that kind of setup at your congregation, right, Sally?
That's right. You know, our network allows us to VPN in as well as have server sessions via Telnet. So we can, you know, get on the computers remotely and, you know, reset things or, you know, troubleshoot problems that might come up. It's kind of easy for us, obviously, because we're right across the street from the school, and so we can, you know, hop over there at any time as well.
And we're going to listen to Mike talk about a solution that they've come up with. And we talked about the theme of the show being thin, and the thin client in his case, as we'll hear him talk about, is a very low-maintenance kind of device that really relies on one server to give all of that information over to those clients. And those clients can last for a long time because there's not a lot of moving parts. He's also going to talk about an operating system called Linux. We haven't talked a lot about that on the show before. But, Sally, I know you ran across an alternate to Linux, which is more educational-focused.
Right. We've been looking at Edubuntu, and we'll include a link in the show notes to Edubuntu software. It is a free open source software available for download from the internet, and it runs very much like what Mike describes the software he's using. It runs on a server, and each of the individual workstations are clients to that server. So if you need to change anything about the software, you change it in that one location on the server, and it automatically flows down to the individual workstations. What's special about Edubuntu is it is a Linux version that's bundled with education software. So it's designed for use in schools. It comes out of the box with OpenOffice.org, which is a free office suite. Also has things geared towards students learning to type and practicing their math skills with a bundle of software that's titled Tux. Tux is the Linux Penguin kind of logo, and they have Tux the Penguin performing typing and math skills and things like that in these Tux software solutions. And then one other piece of software, and there's tons that comes with Edubuntu, but one in particular that I was impressed with is one called GCompre, which is geared toward preschool through 10-year-olds, and just probably 100+ different learning applications, everything from learning how to click the mouse to math and physics type activities for the students to participate in, and just a wonderful suite of software that the students will really be engaged by, and again bundled and free for use with the Edubuntu software.
Sounds great. I'm all for teaching our preschoolers physics.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of good stuff. And lest our church office folks feel left out of the conversation, there's applications out there for them too, although we won't be talking about them in great detail with the interview with Mike Plucker. But just a couple things for you to think about if you're thinking about that virtual office and that thin client is all of the things that are online that allow you to do those office types of things without having the software on your system. We've talked about Google Apps in the past. There's three others that I've come across over the years, and they're excellent as well. One of them is ThinkFree, another is Zoho, and the last one is eDesk Online. And they're, because of the online technologies that are available, the user experience is wonderful. You just have to get used to the idea that you need to be online to use these apps. So there are some limitations there as well. But check those out if you're thinking of trying to focus on portability and the lightweight nature of these applications. And again, all of these are free. Those are worth looking into as well. So without further ado, let's listen to our interview with Mike Plucker, Director of Technology and teacher at St. Paul's Lutheran Elementary School in New Ulm, Minnesota. With us today is teacher Mike Plucker from St. Paul's Lutheran School in New Ulm, Minnesota. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Hey, it's good to be here, Martin and Sally.
We wanted to talk to you a little bit about an entry that you put in the listserv about a thin client computing solution that you've implemented at your school. But first, before we get to that, maybe tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and maybe your experience with technology in general.
Sure. I Boy, I suppose it goes way back. I can remember back to the 1970s. My dad was a pastor in Bay City, Michigan, and you know, he wanted to bring some technology into the church there for membership tracking and things. So in the 70s, I got my hands on a TRS-80, so that was kind of the first computer that I had to work with or kind of played around with as a child. Through high school, went to Michigan Lutheran Seminary, and did some work there with technology, and at Martin Luther College, Dr. Martin Luther College, graduated, and worked at Eastside in Madison, Wisconsin for a number of years, working with some technology there too. For a while, was a principal in Oklahoma City. While I was down there, I served on the Tel-Tech Task Force 2 of the Wisconsin Synod, and took a call here to New Ulm, mainly for technology and for science. My degree is in secondary science, but they wanted someone to work with the technology and teach some other classes here as well. So I've pretty much been involved with technology, with writing and designing websites for some of those things for quite a long time.
What grade do you teach there at St. Paul's?
Pardon me?
What grade there do you teach at St. Paul's?
I teach 7th and 8th grade science, so I have three sections of science, and basically an 8th grade math class and some release time done during the day to work on some technology issues here for our school.
Mm-hmm. So you're the technology director or whatever the position title is. How big is St. Paul's? So how big a student body are you trying to support with the technology there?
Sure, we've got about 230, 250 kids, I suppose, if you talk preschool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 15 or so different classrooms. I know, good thing too with our church, we do have a church administrator, staff minister there who does some technology. We do some projection of worship services and things, so he and I work together from time to time on some of those issues. But so really two campuses, if you will, and most of my work really is done here at the school.
Mm-hmm. Now, schools have a couple different choices when it comes to pushing technology into the curriculum or into the classroom. Some incorporate it right into the classroom, and others set up computer labs where there's lab time that students come in and use the computers and practice their typing skills and, you know, do research, etc. What's the setup there at St. Paul's?
Well, since I arrived, we decided to go more of a blended approach.
Uh-huh.
So we do have a classroom lab, if you will, with 26 or 27 computers in there, terminals in there, and we have a mobile lab that goes from room to room, and then we also make sure that each classroom has 3 to 4 working PCs, and some of the lower grade teachers, for their students, like Macintosh computers, so we have some Macintosh computers down in the lower grade classroom. So really we try to blend it so that the computer is more of a tool that the teachers can use as they're teaching, especially with our mobile lab. But then also, if they want to take the classroom down to the computer lab and maybe do some formal typing or some other issues, they can do that as well. And then with the classroom computers, during the day, the students can go back and do whatever sort of curriculum needs they have right there for that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mike, Martin mentioned earlier that there was a really interesting thread of conversation on the Wells Tech listserv about something called a thin client lab. I understand that computer lab setting you have there with the 26 terminals is functioning in that way. Can you tell us a little bit about what a thin client lab is?
Oh, sure. We have, like I said, we have those 26 thin clients running some servers, or running off a server that's running LTSP, Fedora Core 6. LTSP stands for Linux Terminal Service Project. I would say probably 7 or 8 years ago, someone decided to write some software to help schools with their... A lot of schools really can't afford some of the technology and the cost of it. So he wrote some software to turn computers, older computers, or even newer clients, into kind of an older computing technology, something that had been around before most of us had desktops. And so we've got a setup here that runs that sort of schematic. We have a dual Opteron 64-bit server, 4 gigs of memory, a couple of hard drives in there. Let's see, some other things here. The clients have 128 megabytes on each of them, a compact flash slot in the front of them for memory. The kids want to save some things and take them home. We also have USB ports on them. Basically, what we have is a 1-inch high by 4-inch by 4-inch device that connects to a server. And this terminal, if you will, that sits next to our flat panels and keyboard and mice, works to connect into the server, and then this processing takes place on the server. So that sort of setup helps us out in that. We've got, I would say, a few other computers in there as well. But basically, we have these thin clients that connect to a server to get our computing done.
So all the computing power is actually housed on the server. The terminal that the students are at isn't doing any thinking, basically.
Right, not at all. A thin client is really a network computer without a hard drive. The memory's been scaled way back. There's no fan, there's no disks, there's no moving parts to it. And some people call them diskless or fanless devices as well. But the operating system is pretty much maintained on the server, and the clients log in and establish a session. And with the server that we have with that large memory, it's able to handle all these clients logging in, and then it processes all of the applications, if you will, on the server, and then just transfers the data and sends a screen image back to the client, so the clients look like they're connected or have their own computer, but they can really do the work, but it's all being done on the server.
So that thin client really is thin in a couple different ways, right? It's not doing much. It's really just a portal to the server, and also it's very small. That 1x4x4 block that just sits on the desk. You're saving space there too. How much maintenance? Where do you spend your time doing the maintenance? Obviously, it's not in the on the thin client side. It's probably the care and feeding of the server itself.
Right. Basically, the server is really all that you have to take care of now. These thin clients, since they don't have the hard drives or the power supplies or these moving parts that maybe a traditional PC desktop would, those are the things that you need to replace from time to time. Well, these thin clients don't have any of those, and so they pretty much just exist. The server, however, of course, with its hard drive, you want to make sure you've got an array or some sort of backup for the data on there. But really, any time you need to do software installs or updates, you simply apply them to the server periodically or as need be, and an occasional reboot if necessary, but typically very little reboot. The server is up pretty much all the time, and you just apply anything once to the server, and I found that to be, in our situation here, a great time saving.
Now, Mike, you sound a little geeky to me, which is a compliment. At least on this show it is. If there's listeners out there, let's say principals that maybe don't have a technology director, maybe access to the experience that you have or have had, is this
sure.
something that anybody could do, or do you really need to be kind of on the geeky side to do this?
Well, that's probably the good thing with this sort of setup, this LTSP that we chose to go with here. I think back, 2003, I was looking around for something that could kind of fit what we needed here. I was spending quite a bit of time with updates and software and hardware fixes and things like that, and hit upon something called the K-12 LTSP. And I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting thing here. I wasn't sold on it maybe a few years ago. It had kind of a grassroots, some sort of, like you said, a geeky or kind of a hobbyist feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
I had read some case studies of some schools that were early adopters, and in my opinion, it just really wasn't there yet for some of what our Wisconsin Synod schools need. But as I watched, it kind of became implemented in more mainstream Linux applications, so it's to the point now where you could go online, download some software to put on a CD, you could put that CD into a CD drive, and it would create everything for you. Mm-hmm. So it's really gone away from the old command line typing in what to do. You can put this on a CD, pop it into a few computers, they can turn into clients, and you can put this CD into a server, or to any computer for that matter that has a hard drive, and install the server software there with just a few simple clicks of a button. So they've really simplified the process to make it less geeky, so to speak, so that more people can use it, and especially those without the technology understanding can really get this going.
Yeah, I remember the days where it was not for the faint of heart that somebody would try and install Linux, even though it was free. It came with a pretty heavy payload as far as your ability to get things up and running. This sounds like a plug and play, like you typically buy something off the shelf, load it, and just click the next button to get through the setup screens.
Oh, absolutely. And the one positive thing too with licensing, I know that came up with our discussion on the thread there. You know, under the GPL license, the general public license, it's a license for free use. And then you can also, if you do get into more of the technology aspect of it, you can alter the software any way you need to fit your needs, which I think is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Powerful stuff. What kind of applications are you able to run in this Linux environment? Is it your typical office suite of tools and paint things and things like that that the kids would need in a computer lab?
Oh, sure. That was probably one of the biggest concerns we had here. We had such a great lab already when I got here. You know, quite a bit of network software that we had bought over the years that we were using. And, you know, the teachers use it regularly in their curriculum, and so the main concern was how are we going to, if we move to this way, what sort of software titles would we have or could we use that would complement what we already had? So for our word processing and spreadsheet and our presentation needs, we do use OpenOffice. We also use Tux Paint instead of KidPix. Tux is the mascot of Linux. It's a penguin, and so hence Tux Paint. We use VYM instead of Inspiration, and VYM stands for View Your Mind, and it allows you to do a mind map activity, but it's all computer-based. Instead of drawing the lines and circles, as some teachers may be aware, you have a common theme in your middle, and then you have your subpoints, so it allows you to visually create outline, if you will. Well, this software then allows you to just simply export your visual graphic design into a outline so you can use it to help you write your papers. So those are some of the main titles that we use. There are also some other edutainment software titles, some typing programs that are included free with this install as well. Otherwise, we've simply gone to the web-based approach for our other software needs. We're using our textbook publishers' websites, for example. They've got plenty of worksheets and tutorials and quizzes and activities on them now. So those are some of the things that we've done.
And all those seem to run fine, all those third-party types of things from the textbook providers on that particular system, so you're not losing anything.
Right, and you know the good thing, Martin, is that Flash is part of Linux now. Java
that's right.
is part of Linux now. Adobe is part of Linux, so I can open a PDF in Linux. With our OpenOffice, you can save files as PDF natively. And so so those applications, most online applications, Flash and Java, work really well with the Linux setup.
One question that parents might have is the portability of these documents. So if they have a computer at home, which in most cases is not going to be Linux, are they going to have issues with creating something at home and then bringing it into school to continue working on back and forth like that?
Typically not. I suppose maybe with some of the newer, if you have a newest version of Microsoft Windows or Microsoft Office, I know they have kind of their open document standard, which may be a little bit different. But for the most part, no. The students here, just about all of them in 7th and 8th grade now, have flash drives. And whatever work they do here in OpenOffice, if they have Word at home, they save it as a Word document instead of an OpenOffice document. Take it home, work on it, bring it back, plug the flash drive in, and open it back up into OpenOffice. So really, we haven't run into any issues like that at all.
Right. What are some of the cons? I mean, we've talked about, you know, the benefits, the cost, obviously, is cheap. Well, maybe going back to cost, those thin clients, what do those typically run?
Oh, let's see. I suppose anywhere from $35 if you want to make your own with a simple network card on an old computer all the way up to a few hundred dollars. Mm-hmm. Our price point, we wanted to find something in the $150 price range. We decided to go new instead of using our old computers and just going that $35 network card. But basically $150 is what we found to be adequate for what, say, an elementary school would need. Some of the other cons, though, that you do run into, this type of setup people need to know is really not for heavy multimedia use.
Right.
A lot of the processing is done on that server, and there tend to be the bottlenecks sometimes or slowdowns as that data is transferred back and forth across the network line. So those are a couple of negatives there.
I suppose you do need a pretty solid network because that is your transport mechanism between the thin client and the server. And if that's flaky or not set up correctly, you've got a lot of network traffic or collisions going on with your bits and bytes, that's going to be a problem too.
Oh, absolutely. And with our setup here, too, that is something that I have come across this year, just installing it and putting this in last fall, not really having time to do much testing or work with it before school started. During the year, some issues have cropped up that I do need to address once school's out again.
I was just thinking about summer computer projects here at Sleepy Eye St. John's and thinking about all the planning we're doing for the summer. I'm guessing there are things that you'll want to tweak or maybe change about your setup. Is there anything that you've learned this year that you could share with us to do differently than you did? Or?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Well, once again, with the software, first off, there's the issue that the software that I'm using here is not commercially produced, meaning you get what you pay for. You're not going to get the polished commercial software that many schools are used to using already. But you do have the freedom to modify any of that if you wish. So don't expect Photoshop features when using the Linux-based GIMP to edit your images, I guess. There's also some odd proxy internet and network DHCP issues that do crop up from time to time. Also, too, is kind of a lag time that some users may notice depending on the power of your server. If you're trying to drag images or windows around on your desktop, you will notice kind of a repeated image that shows up, but it does disappear. So I have plans to install this summer some gigabit switches to hopefully allow more, faster transfer of that data. And not only that, I don't have a second server, so I'm thinking, boy, with one of the problems with server-client computing, if your server goes down, your clients don't work. And that was something that I think people need to be aware of with this type of a setup, since everything is run on the server. So I plan to build a second server this summer, have as a backup, and then possibly build another server to split the load. So our lab of 26 on one, maybe we'd have 12 or 13 on one server and see if that'll help ease some of these lag issues, these slowdowns, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like an option that certainly schools could consider. And you kind of have to weigh the pluses and the minuses. The cost is certainly an advantage. The maintenance sounds like a win-win for the administrator there, and it doesn't sound like it's overly technically challenging to set it up and maybe even maintain it. But then you'd lose a few things, as you mentioned, the multimedia, and there are some disadvantages too. But it sounds like a viable option, and it certainly seems like it's working for you.
Oh, sure. The students, too, love it. They've completely adapted to the setup. They're at ease. They go from the thin client lab to the computer on wheels running Windows XP, some of the classrooms with Macintosh computers. So the kids, the neat thing is they're getting exposed to a lot of different types of technology and getting more fluent in other things other than just one specific platform or standard.
And nowadays that is important because it's not just one flavor out there anymore. So.
Exactly.
Mike, thank you so much for taking the time to join us, and we're doing this early in the morning to kind of work around your class schedule. Really appreciate you being able to do that and share this with our listeners. I'm sure that others are interested and maybe even thought about doing this or tried and gave up a while ago because it was too hard. Sounds like things have made some significant progress. So thanks for sharing, and may the Lord continue to bless your work there in New Ulm.
Sure, thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
So it was great to talk to Mike and learn about what he's doing there at St. Paul's in New Ulm. And if you want to learn more and you happen to be a teacher in the Wisconsin area, Mike mentioned to us that he is going to be at the Wisconsin State Teachers Conference coming up in October, being held at WISCO. And he's going to do two sessions on this topic. They actually will be the same session repeated twice. So if you want to learn more, that's your chance to sit and listen to him and ask him questions about this thin client scenario that he's running there at St. Paul's in New Ulm.
Sounds like a growing trend and certainly something to consider if you are in charge of a school computer lab. Certainly the price seems appealing, just a matter of whether it's a good fit for your particular situation. Up next, our pick of the week, or picks of the week. Sally and I each week take a look at what's available either on the internet or utilities that are downloadable, typically free. And we've got a couple of those for you today. Sally, you've got an interesting concept coming up for your pick of the week.
That's right, Martin. I wanted to share with you an alternate keyboard layout called the Dvorak keyboard. Those of us that interact with computers on a regular basis know that it's important that we have great typing skills, and that's something that can really improve our productivity, is to improve our typing skills. And kind of a geeky kind of thing, but I learned about the Dvorak keyboard from my husband, who did a little bit of research, heard about it, read about it, and decided to learn a new language with his fingers on the keyboard, and actually rearranged the keys on his keyboard to a different layout. This layout was designed by a professor in 1932. He was at the University of Washington in Seattle, a Dr. Dvorak, and he developed a simplified layout because the QWERTY layout was actually designed to spread the keys out that you use most frequently. That kind of goes back to the original typewriter designs, when the keystrokes would actually get kind of mangled if you typed too quickly on the typewriter. And so they spread the keys out so that you wouldn't overlap with any of the keys that you use most frequently. And in doing so, they actually kind of slowed us down, or our potential of typing speed down, with that QWERTY layout. So the Dvorak layout was developed, and they claim that it can improve your speed by up to 20% and your accuracy by 50%. And so I guess my husband decided to put it to the test, and if you sit down at his computer to type, and you type the way you're used to typing, you get a very jumbled result.
I would imagine. He actually plucked the keys off of his keyboard and repositioned them on a regular QWERTY keyboard. Okay.
Absolutely. And you know, the concept is that once you learn the keystrokes and you truly touch type, you don't need those keys in place anyway. You know where the keys are, so you could sit down and do it without rearranging the keys or whatever. I found a really great website, Dvorak, a Dvorak zine. It's dvzine.org, and I'll make sure and include a link in the show notes. But kind of a tongue-in-cheek little comic strip that explains all the history behind this, explains how to switch your keyboard if you would like to give it a try. And they really liken it to learning another language. You know, it doesn't, just because you learn Spanish doesn't mean you lose your English or whatever. And this is just a different language for your fingers, and it really can improve your accuracy and speed on the keyboard. So if you're looking to try something new, and maybe improve your productivity a bit, this may be something worth looking into. And again, if I link you to this DV zine in the show notes, you'll have plenty of information to get started with it.
So did Kevin's speed actually increase as a result, or is he still working on that?
No, he says it's noticeable and supposedly pretty easy to make the transition. You know, it didn't take him long, and he's feeling like he's getting much more productivity.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah.
We've mentioned the QWERTY keyboard a couple of times. Of course, it gets its name from the first six keys in the upper left side of the keyboard, and that's typically what you're going to find on almost every computer these days. So, interesting. I don't know that I'm going to jump to switching right away, because I have enough trouble with one language, but I know that there are people out there who swear by this, and that's it's just a really interesting concept. Have you tried typing on it, Sally?
I have, and actually, if I sit down and concentrate on it, it is pretty simple to pick up on. You have all your vowels under your left hand, you know, so they're easy to get to and everything, and it doesn't take long to get used to it, actually. What confuses me is going back and forth between
I would
the
imagine.
Two, and I think,
yeah,
you're always going to have that, because there's always going to be computers that you sit down at that aren't set up that way, but I think, you know, it's worth looking into.
Interesting. Well, my pick of the week doesn't involve a keyboard at all. In fact, it actually takes your words and types them out for you. And it's a little application, a free application called Jot, J-O-T-T. That's www.jott.com. And Jot is really an interesting concept that I've played with a little bit, and now more recently I've gotten a little bit more serious with. But basically, you set up an account on Jot.com, and it sets up a relationship with your, typically your cell phone. And what it enables you to do is to call the JOT number, and it's an 800 number, an 866 number, and you can send either text messages, email messages, reminders, or to-do list items to your email box or to a to-do list online, basically by just saying what you want. It allows 30-second messages, and then it transcribes what you're saying into text. I've tried it on a number of different things, and I've tried to challenge it, and it is really good. It transcribes pretty well. A couple times if you don't speak real clearly, it'll jumble your words. They do say that sometimes they have human intervention necessary. So if the computer is just struggling with something, apparently somebody gets notified and there are actually people transcribing this, but they say everything is totally secure and safe, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's a wonderful tool. So I thought we'd try and do something a little bit here, Sal, and we'll see if this works. I'm going to try and call JOT while we're online here to give our listeners just a good sense for what JOT can do. So the number, I'm going to add a caller here to our Skype call. So this is we're kind of cutting edge here. So let me see if this will work.
There you go.
The number is 866-568-8123. I'm going to go ahead and add JOT to our conversation here. And hopefully everybody can hear this. Dialing now.
Who do you want to JOT?
Self?
JOT yourself.
Order bulletins for Joan's wedding.
Got it. Want a reminder?
Yes.
What day?
Tomorrow.
What time?
8 o'clock.
A.M. or P.M.?
A.M.
Setting reminder for
Wednesday, April 16th, 2008, 8 o'clock, P.M.
Is this correct?
Yes.
Got it. What do you want to JOT?
Reminder.
What day?
Tomorrow.
What time?
10 o'clock.
A.M. or P.M.?
A.M.
Setting reminder for
Wednesday, April 16th, 2008, 10 o'clock, A.M.
Is this correct?
Yes.
Please say the subject of your reminder.
Call Emily to work out details for Vacation Bible School.
Got it. What do you want to JOT?
And I'm going to cancel the call there. Sally, I hope you were able to hear that.
Yeah, I heard. You had a nice computer friend there helping you out.
So what happens is you call, and typically I'll use this if I'm in the car or something like that, if I don't have access to pen and paper or a computer. And essentially what has happened is JOT takes my message, transcribes them, and then does a couple things with them. When I said self, and actually it'll do it in both cases with the reminder and with the call to self, it's going to transcribe my message and then send me an email, and if I choose, a text message on my phone so that I've got that as a reminder. So I've got now a reminder or a note to self to order bulletins, you know, for a wedding that's upcoming, and then I set a reminder to call Emily to work out details for VBS. And actually, if you set a reminder, it's going to email you, and if you choose, text message you 15 minutes before that time as a reminder. So great tool, especially if you don't have access to something that you're going to write stuff down, and my memory is just pitiful. So it's a great tool for me. There's all kinds of other things you can do. You can set up groups to JOT to. So I've got a group called Family, where I can just say family, and it automatically emails every member of my family if I'm running late or, you know, for whatever other reason. You can have as many contacts as you like. You can JOT all kinds of different applications. You can JOT blog posts, if you like, for WordPress. You can even JOT calendar items if you use Google Calendar. So you just say calendar, and it sends it off to Google Calendar, gets that on your calendar. I think just amazing technology that that really has saved me in a couple cases.
Yeah, I tried it out myself last week, Martin, and I couldn't even stump it with my Southern accent. It transcribed me perfectly. So
give it a try, Jot.com. It's free to try, and it's really easy to set up. So give that a shot. Our Wells.net feature of the week. Sally, what do you have for us?
Well, I oftentimes tell people that I think of parts of Wells.net as a treasure chest, and today I'm going to share with you some information about the whataboutjesus.com site, which is managed by our evangelism office and is our outreach tool, basically, on the Wells.net website. And again, I can't help but say it's such a treasure chest. It was originally designed with the unchurched in mind, a comfortable place where they could learn the truths of God's Word, and it's full of just wonderful, wonderful resources. And of course, applies to the unchurched, but certainly applies to those of us who are believers who want to learn more about God's Word. It starts out with Who is Jesus? And has great articles explaining true God and true man nature of Jesus. It has a book-by-book look at the Bible, so you can dig into any book of the Bible and learn about who wrote it and what the setting was and the different things related to the books of the Bible. One of my favorite areas, and one that our techie audience would be interested in, are the interactive Bible studies that are part of the What About Jesus website. There's one on the entire book of John, so you can go on and study the book of John and answer questions and things like that related to the readings that you do. And there's also one called Explore the Bible, which is basically a complete online Bible information class and delves into all the topics that you would cover in a typical Bible information class for someone interested in learning more about God's Word. In addition to the interactive Bible studies, there's also downloadable Bible studies, and I have one of those open on my computer right now. They're in Adobe Acrobat format, and they're basically little booklets that, this one's actually 132 pages long, so significant amount of material available for you to study, and throughout the material there's questions and answers, and you can check your answers at the back of the booklet, but just a great way to study the Word. So if you're looking for some Bible study materials or want to share them with someone maybe in your congregation who's homebound, this would be a good way for them to find Bible study materials. In addition to all that, there's also topical articles about different life concerns, things like your priorities, your relationships, bad habits, dealing with your children. All of those kind of things are covered in some great topical articles on the site. And then another thing that might be of interest to our techies is the worship helps area of the What About Jesus website. Basically what this is the readings as well as some questions and answers related to the upcoming Sunday's Bible readings that'll be shared in church using the standard lectionary series that all of our Wells congregations participate with. And so you can prepare yourself for worship by studying these readings and answering the questions, and there's answers there for you to go by and that kind of thing. And one thing that's really cool about it, just like everything else on Wells.net, is that this worship helps area has an RSS feed. So this would be great for you to display on your church website and allow your members to tap into the readings for the upcoming Sunday and explore those and prepare themselves for worship as it comes up. One other facet of the website that I wanted to mention is that much of the information is available in other languages. So as I was talking about the Bible studies and things like that, there are Spanish Bible studies as well as some in Japanese and Mandarin language available on the website. So just a wonderful outreach tool as well as a wonderful way to use technology for those interactive Bible studies and the worship helps and those kind of things. I invite you to check it out. It's at whataboutjesus.com.
Wonderful resource. I would without hesitation recommend prospects go to this site or new Christians to learn more about their Savior. And I know we've got some non-Wells listeners as listeners to our show, and I would recommend that you could send your unchurched friends and family members here as well. It's fairly non-Wells specific, although there are links to Wells on it. Just great general content about Christianity and who our Savior is. So take a look at whataboutjesus.com.
Just wanted to remind everybody about our current contest. We are giving away a free 1 gigabyte USB thumb drive branded with Wells Technology, a functional tool as well as a keepsake, I suppose, Sally. We do want to hear from you, and you can enter the contest by giving us your top three favorite, and this is a tongue twister each week for me, top three favorite free software tools. So if you find we just need you to share with us three of your favorite software tools that are free of charge, whether you've downloaded them or you've worked other things, take a look at the website at wellstech.wells.net, and you can enter the contest by giving us those entries.
I'm getting real excited about our May 7th show. That's when we'll draw for the winner as well as discuss all the things that have been submitted. And, you know, you and I get a behind-the-scenes look at the entries as they're coming in, and I'm learning stuff already, you know, so it's going to be exciting to share some of these software tools that I wasn't aware of before and maybe kind of compile a list so that others can check out these recommendations.
Community feedback's up next, Sally.
Yeah, we heard from Pastor Ben Kratz. He's at Our Savior in Birmingham, Alabama. And he was really commenting on an interview that we did a few shows ago with missionary Cirilla in Hong Kong and how he's using Skype to do distance ed kind of things there in Hong Kong. Pastor Kratz shared that he's also using Skype. He's not around the world from us. He's down there in Alabama, but he's serving people who are taking Bible information classes maybe 100 miles away from his congregation. So rather than getting in his car and driving a 3-hour round trip or whatever, he's able to connect with them via Skype and teach the Bible information class from his home instead of, you know, having to travel to their home each time. And it's saving them all a lot of time, and they're also, you know, having great Bible study over Skype. So it's just really exciting to hear about the way technology is serving them down in the down at Our Savior in Birmingham, Alabama. And I also wanted to mention that I was quite impressed with his email signature, and it just kind of jogged my mind that it was worth a mention that those of you who aren't using an email signature, this may be something that you want to look into doing. Pastor Kratz actually has quite an extensive email signature. It has his church logo and a link to his congregation, the address information, his email address, phone number, Skype number, all of that kind of information is part of his email signature. So it's automatically part of his email each time he addresses one to someone. And just a kind of a good reminder for us that that's a way that we can share our faith is with our email signature even. And in the digital world, that kind of thing goes along for the ride on all of our emails. And it's a great place to put your contact information as well as other information perhaps about your congregation or school.
Or even just a rotating Bible verse. Sure. I know that a lot of us here in the building will tack on a little Bible verse. And you know, I have an opportunity to interact with, I'm sure, a number of people who are not Christians, whether they be vendors or otherwise for my particular profession here. And just a little reminder, subtle as it might be, in my signature about my Savior, and just a simple way to share God's word with them. Thanks for the feedback. Please keep the feedback coming. You can go to wellstech.wells.net and find out more about how to contact us. You can always email us, enter comments on the show page, and we have a voicemail number that you can actually call in, and we'll put you on the air. So take advantage of those. Well, that's it for this week, Sally. We close, as we always do, with a featured Wells artist. This week, we return to the music of Michael Schrader and his album, A Witness. You can find out more about Michael Schrader's music at michaelschrader.com. The song we're going to listen to this week is John 3:16. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will talk to you next week. Thank you.
slippery slope into my own disgrace. For I did love the world and all that it embraced, but she came to save the lost and their pain erase. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whosoever believeth in him would not perish, could have led the perfect life in place of us. Some through their works and deeds themselves they think they'll save.